Association. However, I am here today because I strongly hope, as I testified and as I wrote all of you in an email, that you will hold back on approving this. The Landmarks Commission, how they approved it, I don't know. They certainly disregarded their criteria in terms of scope and compatibility, and I really hope you will come out and walk this block. This is a treasure of Portland, and what is proposed there in terms of scale and compatibility is just, it's a monstrosity. I support affordable housing, and the other part of my argument is, and I believe I'm allowed to say this, I think this is a bait and switch. We need affordable housing, and this site would be great for affordable housing. But there are no deed restrictions, and there are no conditions here that would require these people to do anything other than say, we're going to give you affordable housing. They're going to give you market rate bait and switch. And I, as a taxpayer who believes that every neighborhood has a responsibility to provide affordable housing, let's make sure we can get it there. And if it would be nice if it didn't look like a woman's prison, but I think it could be great, and I hope you'll stand firm and apply the law and reject this proposal and reject it and let them rework it so that it could be pleasant and have affordable housing in it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fritz.
You have 30 seconds left. I wasn't able to read your email because we're not allowed to read things that are outside of the record. So for anybody else who has sent me information, I have... Unusually, I usually try to read things ahead of time, but for this I haven't. So was there anything else that was in your email that you wanted to make sure the council is aware of?
I primarily had the two arguments because having attended a number of meetings, I never really understood that they were going to push the affordable housing. And when the Landmark Commission approved this, I was flabbergasted because the testimony was so strong that they were totally not meeting any of the criteria for this building.
Thank you.
Yeah, and please come see it. Come walk in our neighborhood. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. My name's Jill Warren, and I own the 10 units of rental property across the street in the historic church and parish. When we bought our buildings, we received a 59-page document from the Department of the Interior of Standards and Guidelines for Rehabilitating Historic Buildings. And I printed out copies for you to review. They're very restrictive covenants. One is limiting any new excavations adjacent to historic foundations to avoid undermining the structural stability of the building or adjacent buildings. When Park 19 was pile driving for new construction a block away, the pounding loosened the pipes in my building on Hoyt, causing leaks. I had to hire a plumber to tighten them up. My historic church is across the street on 18th Avenue, and I'm concerned about damage to the stained glass windows that were brought over on a ship in the late 1800s by Norwegian immigrants or other structural damage. My historic buildings are fragile. We've testified in front of the Historic Landmarks Commission several times, and they've concurred with us time and again until it was announced that the new construction would be used for affordable housing. Nowhere in the Standards for Rehabilitation grants exceptions to the covenants based on who the tenants are. The standards are so restrictive, I'm not allowed to make major changes to my buildings due to their historic status. And the historic rentals are the last bastion of affordable housing in that area. My top rent for a two-bedroom is $1,650 a month. Park 19, their top rent is $4,500 a month. So we're caretakers of these historic landmarks, and we need to maintain their value. Massive new construction would dwarf surrounding buildings and compromise the neighborhood. I see tour groups taking pictures and admiring the architecture. Massive new construction would dilute the historic value, and once it's gone, it's gone. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Vicki Scria. I live across the street in one of the treatment homes. I want you to know that I'm an artist.
One moment. I'm not sure the mic's working.
Oh.
And we'll restart the clock.
I'm sorry. Did I lose my 10 seconds?
Not at all.
Okay. My name is Vicki Scria, and I live across the street in one of the Trinkman homes. I want you to know that I'm an ardent supporter of affordable housing, have been so for 40 years. I've worked in the field. I've been an affordable housing consultant, a housing and homeless services manager at the state, and a director of permanent supportive housing evaluation project, and have talked to a lot of, as part of my job, talked to a lot of people that live in housing. I'm asking that you reverse the HLC decision and deny the proposed design. I commented extensively in my comments that are on the record, and you've already heard like what some of the main points are why this design does not meet the criteria. I wanted to talk a little bit about how expensive it is to build affordable housing these days. When I was a housing consultant and worked on several complexes that still exist today in Portland, I had a straightforward no-frills approach. What I tried to do was roll up my sleeves, look at all the requirements, make sure that before I moved a project forward, that it moved forward, that it met all the requirements. And I guess I feel not very good that this project has taken so long, that there's been so many meetings with teams of lawyers where neighbors have been accused as NIMBY when we really support an affordable housing project and would love to see one that is at an appropriate scale. On the record, there's been shared two projects that NHA previously did. One is the Oak Ridge project in Lake Oswego that has 45 subsidized spacious one-bedroom apartments on a 29,000-square-foot lot. Then there's the Alma Gardens project in Hillsboro that has another 45 spacious one-bedroom apartments on a 31,000-square-foot lot. Just in comparison, this has 147 units all scrunched down on a 20,000-square-foot lot. I think we could stop wasting a lot of time, be much more straightforward, get those units on the ground if all the criteria are met. If it's not and this project moves forward, there's going to be continued obstacles because the federal funding subsidies that might be applied for require adherence to federal standards like Jill mentioned, and the what was approved under the criteria are not inconsistent with those federal standards. So thank you. Sorry.
Thank you.
And next we have Dan Anderson, Richard Uren, Jessica Richmond.
Good afternoon. If you'd like to go ahead and start, sir, you may.
Mr. Mayor, commissioners, I'm Daniel Anderson. I live two blocks from the project site. I've lived in this neighborhood since 1981, both as a renter and as an owner. I support the development of scale-compatible, bona fide affordable housing in my immediate neighborhood. The proposal before you today is unlikely to deliver either of these outcomes. Because of this, the City Council should reverse the landmark decision and deny this proposal. Should do this for two reasons. First, the development fails to meet multiple mandatory review criteria in the community design guidelines and in the Alphabet Historic District addendum. Secondly, the proposal and the record, while making repeated references to the project as being affordable housing, includes no protections to ensure that the result will be anything other than full frontal market rate rental housing. The council should take steps to immunize itself and the public from being party to a bait-and-switch scenario wherein the council is baited to overlook dubious design and massing aspects of the proposal because the proposal might supply affordable housing. In today's development cost environment, delivering affordable housing depends on access to significant public subventions. And despite multiple applications for these by the developer, these subventions have yet to be forthcoming for this project. Because the project's history of difficulties in securing the necessary public subventions, there's a very good chance that the project will be switched to the type of market rate workforce housing, which the market is already supplying in quantity in this neighborhood. In short, we'd get an incompatible building which fails to deliver affordable housing, a worst of both worlds outcome. The council could immunize itself and the public against such a bait-and-switch outcome by requiring the applicant, as a condition of approval, to enter into a recorded long-term affordable housing restrictive use agreement prior to the issuance of a building permit. Such agreements are a common feature of this world of affordable housing, where they serve to align promises and outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
My name is Richard Uren. My wife and I have lived on the corner of 18th and Irving for 24 years. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to testify about this issue here. And in fact, there are several issues. The most prominent one is the decision of the Historic Landmarks Commission to approve of this housing proposal. We think this was a flawed decision. Several of the approval criteria of this project were not met. They are summarized nicely in the Northwest District Association's letter of appeal. Both proposed buildings are incompatible in size and design with the historic context of the surrounding neighborhood, which on just two streets, Hoyt and Irving, contains 13 houses on the National Historic Register. We have two additional concerns. We worry that the units built on the, under the appellation of affordable housing will not remain that way. There is nothing in my knowledge that would prevent the owners from converting it to market rate housing down the line, as you so eloquently articulated. Our second concern is the impact of the inordinate size of the project and its parking element on the neighborhood and community. Can I comment briefly on this or not?
Unless someone objects, you can. Yeah, I don't know what.
You've heard that our neighborhood is probably the densest in the
state.
In the state, yes. It's often impossible to get parking during the day. This is a problem for those of us who live there, of course, but it will be an even bigger problem for those who move into the apartments. It is unrealistic to think that seniors and others will ditch their cars for bikes and scooters. We should remember that seniors have caregivers, families, and friends who will come to see them and have to park. Already, repairmen have refused to work on our houses because of the difficulty finding parking. We worry that the size of this project and the associated parking issue will make the neighborhood and the community a much more difficult place to live and work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Jessica Richmond, speaking for myself, long time nearby resident, long time city planner for Portland. Three quick remarks. First, the discussion about bait and switch. I want to be very clear that although many of us are concerned about market rate housing being built here instead of affordable, we're not concerned about NHA doing that. We know they're not in the business of market rate housing. It's just if they aren't able to get funding and another developer comes in, we're not casting aspersions on them. Second, I wanted to also emphasize that many of us are, including Vicky, have been advocates for affordable housing for many years. For myself, I'm coming up on my 45th year of housing advocacy, including when I worked for the city, working on the project Strategies for Fair Housing that became a national model for siting special needs housing and is still the outstanding model in this country and is one of the things I'm proudest of in my life. And finally, this doesn't relate specifically to the criteria, but to the purpose of the historic districts. I'm hearing a lot, and you are, that Portland's changing. It's not Portland anymore. We're losing our special character. The historic districts are the one area where that character is preserved. And in this particular tiny little bit of Northwest, you can still see what it was like many years ago. And so to keep that special character, we ask that you deny this proposal or ask for significant revisions. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the last speaker we have is Alan Buller.
Here he comes. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, ladies
Welcome.
And gentlemen. My name is Alan, and I also live adjacent to this proposed development. I'd just like to essentially support what I feel are the failure based upon the massing of this project and also the design compatibility, as well as no guarantee that this will be affordable housing, because a number of people have commented on the bait and switch aspect of this thing. I would just like to comment briefly on, and I want to totally support all of those who commented in a positive way about their support for affordable housing. We've never said that. As a matter of fact, it's kind of curious that this is the third proposal on this site and the first one that has that as a catchphrase in terms of trying to attempt to get this approved. And so I would caution, I know that Nick Fish had extensive questions for one of the co-applicants during the initial testimony in January of 2015. Unfortunately, I don't have the specific line, but it's, I'm sure it's a matter of record. And during that time, he questioned the applicants repeatedly about their ability to get to the 60% in terms of the income requirements here, and they repeatedly said they could not do that. And so now suddenly they can do that. I would question that that miracle that happened between then and now. And then the final thing I would say is that in respect, just a few more seconds, in a few more, you know, in the context of 97209, this zip code where this is, I want to reiterate, this is the most dense zip code by population in the state of Oregon. And it's also like within the zip codes within the city of Portland, it's 30th out of 32nd in median income. So clearly there is affordable housing here. There's below market, you know, in people that don't have the same income. And then also I would mention that there's a 12.2% vacancy rate. I can send all of these references to each one of you if you want to verify that. But there's a 12.2% vacancy rate in 97209. I would suggest that that some form of support for affordable housing in terms of assisting those rent assistance would be appropriate while we search for a credible solution to this problem. And I would love to see something there.
Thank you for your testimony.
Very good. Commissioner Fritz, I'm sorry.
I have a question for the city attorney. Was the council's discussion and decision in 2015 discussed at the Landmarks Commission?
That's a question for staff. Can staff speak to that?
I'll ask you later then.
Hi, Hillary Adam, BDS. The council discussion wasn't part of the Landmarks discussion for this case, but the council decision for the 2014 demolition review that was added to the record.
Okay.
So the findings for that are in the record.
Thank you.
I also have a question, and I believe I know the answer, but was there any increased benefits as far as FAR or height or any of these modifications tied to an affordability requirement or promise?
I don't believe.
I don't think so. Okay, thank you.
But they're not asking for any.
Well, but I'm just getting the sense from the testimony that there's a belief that this project's being allowed to go forward when it wouldn't otherwise be because of the promise of
affordable housing. It's actually under the maximum FAR.
Thank you.
So I think the concern is that the design criteria and the historic landmarks criteria have been kind of, the question is, have they been ignored because it's been promised? Mm. And so that was kind of part of my questions for the modification for the loading dock and your good question about the landscaping as to whether that plays in.
So if I could muse aloud on this same theme, we have no way of knowing intent, obviously, other than looking at the criteria themselves and determining whether or not we believe that this is consistent with the criteria, the design criteria.
And, I mean, can we have any kind of conversation at this point, or should we move forward and save it for the end?
Yeah, it might be worth saving council discussion until after you hear from the applicant.
Very good. Next up, the principal opponent. You have 30 minutes plus 2 minutes and 3 seconds, should you choose to take it. Again, name for the record. Names for the record. Thank you. Ask legal counsel a question while we're getting the presentation set up. The principal opponent time frame, is that established based on the time of the staff report plus the total appellant testimony? Is that how we're coming to the 30 minutes?
It's the 30 minutes. So typically the principal opponent or the applicant here would get 15 minutes, but with two appellants, they got extra time.
Okay.
I don't know if they intend to use it all.
Okay. And is that agreed upon, or is that just the standard that we typically
it
use?
It is a standard that the city has consistently applied, and then what ultimately what we notice the parties is what's set out today. So this is what everyone's been noticed and kind of came today knowing would be the time allowed.
Okay. I was just curious. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Is it good to go, Sue? Is it working? Yeah, there
we go. It's not quite what we want, but I think it's what our system will allow here.
Is there a teenager in the house?
I was going to say. We need a digital native in the room.
Oh, you were so close.
Uh-oh, what are we going to see here?
Sorry, Sue. Can you come do it again?
Oh.
I figured out how to shrink it, but it's...
We just need to start again.
Perfect with the interview for good.
Yes. Yeah, that was... Very good example.
Okay.
So if you want, why don't you move it up to 32 minutes, just because there was the appellants took a little extra time.
Thank you and good afternoon. My name is Cosette Tran-Cafe. I'm with the law firm of Lane Powell, and we're a land use counsel for the applicant, Northwest Housing Alternatives. We've submitted a detailed written response to the legal issues raised in the appeals, and I'll be available to answer any questions you have on those. But because this review is really focused on the project design, our design professional and applicant are going to handle the bulk of the presentation today. First, you'll hear from Trell Anderson. He's the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. He'll give brief background on the organization and an introduction to the project. And then Michelle Black with Carlton Hart Architects will explain the research that went into the project, that went into getting to know the historic Alphabet District, and she'll walk you through the design process as well. And then Michelle and I will address the specific legal issues raised in the appeal and the additional issues raised today as well.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler, council members. My name is Trell Anderson. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're the we're an affordable housing developer of 1,800 units across the state. We introduced this project initially as affordable housing because we wanted to provide transparency to our intentions at the site. Yet our landmarks process has focused on the design and compatibility. The ideal is to provide affordable housing in a high opportunity area that will provide access to transit, shopping, jobs, education, healthy foods and services, all while reducing the need and expense of a car. These are also the policy goals of the City of Portland. We appreciate all of the comments here today in support of affordable housing. Northwest Housing Alternatives has experience with adaptive reuse and upgrade of historic properties, such as what we've proposed here. We're neighbors with two historic properties in the Alphabet District, the Roslyn and Victorian Inn Apartments, and one asset in the Piedmont neighborhood called Rosemont. My point here is that we're not new to this, and we're committed to historic preservation. This project is complicated, and the fact is not taken lightly. We understand the process, and we invested the time and resources to submit a compatible and compliant development proposal. The team undertook an extensive amount of research and outreach that influenced the design before you today. The design process was developed and refined. The design itself was developed and refined over a course of essentially 2 years and included numerous meetings with BDS staff and stakeholders, 3 meetings with the neighborhood, 3 DARs, and 1 historic resource review before being approved by the Historic Landmarks Commission. By listening to stakeholders, we made changes, additions, and amendments. We also made concessions. One example is that we first brought forward a 6-story building for the North Building. But after feedback, listening, and consideration, we made changes, including the elimination of a full story and the loss of 14 to 17 total units, as much as 10% to accommodate. Arriving here today, it's taken time, effort, and expense to get here. But the team's diligence resulted in BDS staff citing that all approval codes and guidelines have been met, and the Historic Landmarks Commission agreed to vote to support the project. We thank you for your time and consideration this afternoon. I'd be happy to answer any questions about NHA, and we have our experts, team members that will lead us through the rest of the proposal.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Black from Carlton Hart Architecture, and I'm going to walk through some of the context research as well as the design. So we're in the Historic Alphabet District, and to look in and see what the thesis of the Historic Alphabet District is, we look to the Statement of Significance, and I'm going to read this aloud. The district's multifamily dwellings are noteworthy for their appearance in an area that retains buildings from its early development period. Grand single-family homes sit next to first-class apartment buildings in a physical representation of the socio-cultural transition experienced by one of Portland's oldest neighborhoods. This is taken from the Historic Alphabet District Community Design Guidelines Addendum, and this is really tells us what is important with this neighborhood, why this neighborhood was designated a historic district, and what is what the characteristics are that we should be trying to abide by. So this is the immediate context. You've heard the neighbors speak about this, the context. In the on the map, the site in red is us. And just to go quickly, you've seen many of these images before. But this really speaks to, just from these photos taken from our site, this speaks to what the neighborhood is. You see single-family homes. You see low-rise multi-family. You see commercial. You see a church. And beyond the Associated Oil Building in the here, you see multifamily. There is a mix of architectural styles, a mix of sizes, a mix of scale, as well as just how these buildings are sited. So residential buildings typically are set back from the sidewalk, whereas commercial buildings and larger multifamily buildings are sited right up to the sidewalk. This is the diversity of the neighborhood. Then we take a little step out. As Commissioner Udaly was talking about, there's a vast variety of architectural styles, sizes, types in this neighborhood. And this is just showing another cluster of buildings found throughout the district. The ones that have the dashed line around them are some of the buildings that we used and really referencing for our building designs. So height has been talked about a lot. This is a map of the district, and it has been color-coded for heights. Gives you a sense of where we are in the district. So we're this red rectangle over on the east side. And you don't need to get into the specifics, really, but from the lightest blue, which is a one-story building, up into that very dark midnight blue, which is a six-plus story building, and the heights of those are written on them. You see just what it looks like in this district. There are short buildings next to tall buildings. There's 12-story buildings. There are one-story buildings. This is the diversity of the neighborhood.
And I'm assuming that's in the record.
That's ma'am. It is.
Thank you.
And just as much as the height variation is seen across the neighborhood, it is really this proximity of tall next to short that is so prevalent in the neighborhood. As one example, on the top left here, this is the Everett apartment building next to a residence. This is a 57, both of these are contributing buildings to the neighborhood. This is a 57-foot tall multifamily next to a 26-foot tall house. This is what the neighborhood looks like. So just as much as there's height variation, the proximity of all these buildings is close. It is the dense neighborhood that the neighbors have spoken about. And multifamily buildings are prevalent in the neighborhood. We see this. These buildings adhere to classic urban design principles by creating, they build right up to the sidewalk. There is very little setback. If anything, there's a small landscape buffer along some of these, but these buildings really hold an urban edge. And then there have been new buildings that have been approved in the district of size. Each of these has been approved since the district has been designated a historic district. Excuse me. And so, getting to the building design, okay. So as you saw from staff, we have our building design is based off of building three separate-looking structures. Though the South Addition is an addition to the contributing Buck Prager building, it is made to look as a standalone building. Really, that intent was trying to get the Buck Prager building to exist as its own, so it still has the prominence that it does today. So the design of this was looking at surrounding buildings through the district and really looking at the fine-grained detail of the district. As you walk down the street and you experience these different types of buildings, different scales, different details. So getting to the renovation and upgrades to the Buck Prager building itself, we're relying heavily on historic photographs to tell us what this building originally looked like. Thankfully, the facade is in relatively good shape and hasn't been altered too much over time. It has lost this decorative eyebrow piece and canopy, and the lower ground floor windows have been filled up. So we plan to restore all of that, replace the replacement windows that currently are in there with more historic character wood windows, remaking and reinstalling the eyebrow, remaking a canopy, and of course there's significant seismic and fire life safety upgrades that will have to be made to this building. But the intent is to keep it of the character that it once was. And the South Addition. So this is a tricky design problem, that to make an addition that looks like its own building yet has enough of a relationship to its contributing building that it's attaching to. So very careful analysis was done with this building, and this was one that we did have a lot of feedback from the Landmarks Commission and went back and forth with some of the design suggestions that they gave. And so really looking at how the makeup of the Buck Prager facade can be taken through to the south building, carrying across the horizontal datum lines, holding to this base, and there's a brick top to both of these, and then there's a smooth coat base, so carrying that through. And then also there's this very specific rhythm, 4-foot rhythm of solid versus openings. Solid versus openings that carries across this symmetrical facade, and continuing that in the south addition as well. And the key to making the Buck Prager still its own structure and of its own historic integrity is this change of color. So allowing the south building to kind of take a more muted stance with those darker colors. And here's a rendering looking at the south building, the Buck Prager, and the north building beyond. You'll see along Hoyt Street, there is a notch along the center of that facade, just, again, breaking up the massing of that facade, changing the materiality of that just to give smaller masses along the more residential street. And then this slide is showing you design influences of the north building. These are each contributing buildings within the district. And really looking at what is a characteristic multifamily mid-rise building in the district, we started to see some constant themes. This idea of a base, middle, cap, or order to the building, oriel windows. On several of these, a rusticated base, where that's the detail of the base. Trying to break up bigger facades with change in materials and change of color. And then for our oriel windows, really, we looked at the Campbell townhomes that have these unique squared oriel bays to them, and the change in from a wood oriel to the brick facade.
Is that oriel, like the bird?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Because it doesn't come all the way down to the ground, so it's suspended there. Okay. Anyway, so looking at here's a rendering of the north building. Again, so this change in material from brick to wood, having these very detailed bandings, the strong cornice and the bandings at several places across the facade, this notch was added in as part of our, again, discussions with Landmarks Commission, and then a deeper inset at the top to really start to create this space between these volumes. The larger inset along the 18th Avenue side at the front entrance to give there some different experience along the pedestrian path there. So now we're going to address the approval criteria. So this project is has two different sets of approval criteria, three from the Historic Alphabet District Guidelines, 1, 2, and 3, and then we have 16 from the Community Design Guidelines that we must meet. And BDS staff recommended approval, and the Landmarks Commission granted approval, saying we met all of them. And these are the six guidelines that are referenced in the appeals, and we will address each of them.
Do you want to talk about affordability first? Let's do this. Okay.
Sorry. So I'm going to read the guideline. This is Historic Alphabet District Guideline number 2 states, differentiate new from old. New addition, exterior alterations, or related new construction will retain historic materials that characterize a property to the extent practicable. Replacement materials should be reasonable facsimiles of the historic materials they replace, and the design of new construction will be compatible with the historic qualities of the district as identified in the historic context statement. So a project complicated like ours, where we have a new building, an existing historic structure, and an addition, you have to start to piecemeal these out. So the top portion here is going to reference the Buck Prager and South addition because it's talking about additions and existing structures. The middle, talking about replacement materials, is really applying to the Buck Prager, and the final, talking about design of new construction, is related to the North Building. And I've just gone through the design with you briefly. So the guideline is being met by, first of all, the South Addition is taking design cues from the Buck Prager. The Buck Prager itself is being restored to its historic character. And then the North Building is utilizing design ideas from other buildings in the district.
Could I ask you a question just for my own clarification? So when you say the guidelines are met by, and then you list, this is the Historic Landmarks Commission's opinion, or is this your, whose opinion is this when you say the guidelines are met by?
I can say that this is my opinion, but these were presented as part of a much lengthier list of how we're meeting the guidelines. And they felt we met the guideline, whether it's specific to this or not.
For the most part, the decision references, but like incorporates by reference, the materials that the applicant submitted in its application.
Okay. So, thank you.
Yeah. But just as far as the wording is not like specific from their findings, if that's
okay.
the question.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I understood whose views were being represented
yes.
here.
Thanks for clarifying.
So as we heard, one of the main objections under this guideline is related to the size of the new buildings, which the appellants have argued grossly overwhelmed the Buck Prager. Under this particular guideline, I'll use the term guideline and criterion interchangeably because here the guidelines are the criteria, just to clarify that. This objection is just misplaced under this guideline, which focuses on the historic materials and the design detailing and not the size or the scale of the buildings. Their second main objection is that the South Addition just isn't sufficiently related to the Buck Prager, but as Michelle sort of talked you through in some detail just a minute ago, the South Addition really does respond pretty closely to the Buck Prager and is designed carefully to reference that building but not copy it exactly. Third, and this is a theme that sort of repeats itself through all of the appeals, is the appellants want this guideline to focus on just this subset of nearby houses, but the correct frame of reference under the criterion is the historic alphabet district as a whole.
So historic alphabet district guideline number 3 speaks to a hierarchy of compatibility, and that reads, exterior alterations and additions will be designed to be compatible primarily with the original resource, secondarily with adjacent properties, and finally, if located within a historic or conservation district, with the rest of the district. Where practical, compatibility will be pursued on all 3 levels. And then the second part of that is new development will seek to incorporate design themes characteristic of similar buildings in the historic alphabet district. So similarly to the last guideline, this gets applied to our project in its piecemeal way, if you will. The first would be where it's talking about exterior alterations and additions apply to the south addition, where you meet the hierarchy of compatibility. Whereas the second portion talking about new development applies to our north building that says we're seeking to incorporate design themes, characteristics of similar buildings in the historic district. So as far as how we're meeting this, again, I showed you how the design of the south building is responding to the Buck Prager, and then the north building taking design cues from other buildings in the historic alphabet district.
I'll start with the north building here because of some of the arguments that were raised earlier by the appellants. The ones that we've discussed already are just whether a different hierarchy, whether the three-tiered hierarchy applies to new development. And I think it's pretty clear from the wording of the guideline that for new development, it's only compatibility with similar
similar buildings in the historic Alphabet District. And now we've heard a new argument that the north building should really be considered an exterior alteration and rather than a new development. So I just, if you'll bear with me, want to
That's
read.
A new argument, though, so I don't think you need to address it.
Huh?
Isn't that a new argument, so you don't need to address it?
Well, let's...
You'd like to anyway,
guys. Yes. So, under the code, the definition of new development...
Where's our legal counsel?
There.
Could we get an opinion on that before we move on?
Well, they didn't object, so I think they get to respond.
Okay, I just want to, we're back to the arguments around hierarchy, and I just want to make sure that we're not going down a road that we should not be going down. Could you repeat the issue,
so
please, for legal counsel?
This is whether the north building should be considered an exterior alteration or new development under the code definitions, and we raised the objection that was a new argument, but I also wanted to address it substantively.
Yeah, so
my understanding from staff is that the argument that this... that
is your microphone on?
Nope.
Turned it off right before I started speaking. Thank you. Okay, my understanding from staff is that this argument was not raised before the Landmarks Commission. It is a new argument. However, the notice, which identifies that applicants are only allowed to raise new issues, does not specifically exclude them from raising new argument. So although technically, and that's what we state at the beginning of the hearing and traditionally what we require, our notice did not provide that fair warning. So we are allowing the parties to raise an objection. We are alerting to council. However, to the extent council does want to consider it and think it's fair to consider it, I think that staff is also prepared to respond to that argument today.
Okay,
or the applicant.
Then that's fine. I just wanted the clarification because this is an appeals process. And so the idea of bringing new ideas to the table isn't necessarily something I feel 100% comfortable with, except in this case, it sounds like both parties or all parties are in agreement that it is okay and they're willing to have this discussion.
Well, to the extent that council just wants to disregard the new argument, we would be supportive of that as well. But because it's been raised, I would like to address it.
You're worried that we can't unforget it.
Yes. So I just want to read, it'll be very brief, the definition of new development under the code, and that's development of a site that was previously unimproved or that has had previously existing buildings demolished, and that is exactly what's going to happen on the site where the north building will be built. Right now it's a surface parking lot and a one-story residential structure. The structure will be raised and the north building will be built there. So it clearly falls under the definition of new development and not exterior alteration or addition. So the point there is just that because it's new development, it only has to be compatible with similar buildings in the district as a whole. And Michelle showed you several examples of other mid-rise multifamily buildings that the north building responds to from a design standpoint. And then with respect to the south addition, we really need to look at the hierarchy. The most important thing is responsiveness and compatibility to the original resource, which is the Buck Prager. And we've talked in some detail about those design features. Oh, sorry. I just can't stop talking. Also, the appellant's interpretation of compatibility is unduly narrow. They really want to argue that the buildings have to be similar to these nearby buildings, but similarity, compatibility doesn't mean similarity. And if we look at the Landmarks Commission's guide to the historic review process, and this is quoting from that guide, new buildings do not have to be copies of historic buildings to be compatible, and fitting in is not the same thing as uniformity.
So now we go to the community design guidelines. P1, plan area character. Enhance the sense of place and identity by incorporating site and building design features that respond to the area's desired characteristics and traditions. And so the multiple, how we're meeting this guideline is the multiple distinct buildings along the length of a block is something that we see throughout the district. The articulated facade designs incorporating details that are found throughout the district, creating an urban edge along 18th Avenue and landscape setbacks on Hoyt and Irving. Rehabilitation of the Buck Prager itself and compatible south addition to the Buck Prager.
Here, the appellant's argument is similar to some of their other arguments, that the new buildings under this guideline need to be similar to that subset of nearby houses. But what the desired characteristics and traditions here is actually a specifically defined term. It's found in the Northwest District Area Plan, and specifically in a section of that called the Eastern Edge Desired Characteristics and Traditions, because this property is in the sub area, the Eastern Edge sub area of the Northwest District Plan area. So there are three applicable desired characteristics outlined in that plan. The first is contribution to the architectural diversity of the Eastern Edge. We've seen that this project does that. The second desired characteristic is continuation of the established pattern of partial block massing, and we've seen that this project also does that. And then the third desired characteristic is preservation of historic resources in the historic Alphabet District. And here, of course, this project is restoring the Buck Prager and rehabilitating it, so we've satisfied that as well.
Community Design Guideline Number 2, Historic and Conservation Districts. Enhance the identity of historic and conservation districts by incorporating site and building design features that reinforce the area's historic significance. Near historic and conservation districts use such features to reinforce and complement the historic area. So how we're meeting this guideline is through the full upgrade of the Buck Prager and sensitive restoration of its facade elements, compatible south addition to the Buck Prager, a north building that's influenced by historic buildings in the district, as well as we have site amenities such as mirroring the brick pavers that are found across Irving Street, as well as other landscaping.
The main argument raised under this guideline has been that the Landmarks Commission didn't make the same findings or perform the same analysis as council did a few years ago with respect to the demolition review. We saw in Grace's presentation sort of the main difference between these two reviews is that this project is proposing to rehabilitate and save the Buck Prager, and the previous demolition review was for demolition of that building. But also we saw in Grace's presentation just the difference in size between these two projects. That was a full half block. This is several related but distinct from a design perspective buildings that are much smaller and that, you know, retain the historic resource. In addition, there's no requirement that each land use review end up with the same analysis or make the same findings. And in this case, you really couldn't, because the applicable approval criteria, it's a completely separate set of applicable approval criteria for this than it was for the demolition review.
Community Design Guideline D6, Architectural Integrity. Respect the original character of buildings when making modifications that affect the exterior. Make additions compatible in scale, color, details, material proportion, and character with the existing building. We're meeting this by providing full systems upgrades to the Buck Prager, conducting a sensitive restoration of the facade elements, and its addition is compatible with it.
There's not too much to say from a legal perspective on this architectural integrity guideline, and I also want to save time to address the request for an affordability covenant. So unless you guys have questions.
And then Community Design Guideline D7, blending into the neighborhood. Reduce the impact of new development on established neighborhoods by incorporating elements of nearby quality buildings such as building details, massing, proportions, and materials. So the exterior wall areas are divided into distinct smaller planes, especially along Hoyt and Irving Streets, really breaking down the massing of our buildings. There's differentiation in materials and detailing that we find throughout the district. Mm-hmm. The South Addition, again, is compatible with the Buck Prager, and there's landscaping setbacks along the transitions to those more residential streets of Hoyt and Irving.
You've seen, and Michelle's just reminded you of the site design and building design details that the project uses to sort of reduce its impact on the neighborhood. This is another area where the appellants really want us to focus again just on that subset of houses, but really the frame of reference is the neighborhood. And I think we should also look, even, like, let's assume that really we're only looking at the immediately adjacent properties. Even just the ones that are either directly touch the site, the project site, or just across the street from the site, there's a good deal of diversity just in those properties. There's the Buck Prager, obviously. It's a flat-roofed institutional building. There's also a flat-roofed office building, a flat-roofed community service center attached to the church, one of the two churches, a couple of multifamily buildings, including the converted church, which will actually be just about the same height as the South Addition, or even maybe a little bit taller. So this project really does blend into the diversity of the neighborhood. Before we conclude, I do want to address the requested affordability condition. I'll address it from a legal standpoint, and then Trell can address it from a practical standpoint. There's been some suggestion that this affordable housing proposal has sort of colored the Landmarks Commission's assessment and even, I guess, the neighbor's assessment of the design. You've seen in our presentation, which is similar to what was presented before Landmarks Commission, that the focus really is on the design. And in the decision, the Landmarks Commission has made it very clear that whether or not these units are affordable is not relevant to the applicable approval criteria in this design-focused review. So from a legal standpoint, imposing an affordability condition, because it's not relevant to the applicable approval criteria and it's not otherwise authorized by the code, would be beyond the authority of this review, beyond the scope of this review.
From a
yes. Oh, go ahead, Charles. Go ahead and finish the roll.
Thank you. I was just going to say, from a practical standpoint, you know, you two as the housing commissioners know this, anytime we apply for public funding to subsidize these units, there will be a covenant restriction on the property for terms. We do intend to apply for funding from the City of Portland. We're eyeballing the bond funds that have recently been approved. That will come with deed restrictions and affordability compliance period. I believe Portland Housing Bureau is now talking about 99-year affordability period. So, as you know, that's down the road as we secure the funding to do the affordable housing.
Commissioner Fritz.
So would you be willing to add a voluntary condition of approval holding it to 60% of median family income?
Commissioner, thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, our mission is to provide 100% affordable housing in what we do. I'm hesitant to commit to any level in this process, because that needs to be negotiated as the funding comes in. There are so many different levers that determine the rate of affordability of each unit. We can have a number of different affordability ranges within one property, and it really depends on the amount of subsidy that comes in for the type of unit within a building.
You don't provide workforce housing, do you?
Well, that's
do you provide 80%?
Workforce housing is a debatable term, so I hesitate.
Do you provide 80% and 100% market rate housing?
I hesitate.
We have
1,800 units in portfolio. None of them are above 80% median family income.
That's why I was so, because I think there is a legal nexus with the waiving of the loading dock the loading space, that it's prefaced on either it being senior housing or studio apartments. And the argument was made people are not going to have a lot of stuff because they're either elderly or have low incomes. The challenge, so I do think that there's a relevance to that particular adjustment in the approval criteria in 805.040. So that's, if you could be thinking about, is there something that you could agree to as a condition of approval of that modification, of that adjustment, that would still be well within the range of what you do and give some assurance that it's not, if the city funding or whatever funding doesn't come through, it's not going to be then sold off for market rate housing with massive apartments that will need large, much more of the loading and unloading capacity.
Can I just